Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone is our first guest, Dr. Dorcita Taylor. Dr. Taylor is with the University of Michigan. She is the professor of environmental sciences, environmental sociology. And Nell, you said that Dr. Taylor has a new job coming up?
Well, if I read this right, Dr. Taylor, online, I see that you're about to join the faculty at the Yale University Environment School. Is that right?
Yes, that is. Starting on July 1st, I will be affiliated with the Yale School All for Environment.
That's fantastic because that, among other things, is Nell's alma mater, right?
Right. So I have a personal excitement about this, but
maybe you'll go back to school.
This will be the thing that gets me back.
Yes. Well, what year did you graduate?
In 2006.
Okay, right. It's my alma mater too, so it's returning to New Haven with some excitement and interest in seeing how I can help move things along there.
Well, we want to talk a little bit more about the arc of your educational career and why you got into the environmental field. We'll get to that in a little bit, but we want to start with this concept of environmental racism. And I thought typically we go through definition of terms here on This Green Earth. So if you could give us a definition of what environmental racism is.
We can think about environmental racism as very deliberate acts that have negative impacts, negative environmental impacts on people of color, their communities, as well as low-income people and their communities. We can think of racism also in terms of not just what one individual does to another, but the institutional pieces that make it possible. And just as the Webster Dictionary has just changed the definition of racism to move beyond racism that's interpersonal to incorporating the institutional piece in racism, the same thing goes for environment. So if we think of residential segregation, yes, we have whites that do not want to live in communities with blacks, particularly blacks, but also other people of color. But that in and of itself does not explain the extreme segregation that we have seen in this country for the last 100 years or so. We know that government institutions also played a role in segregation by redlining, literally putting a line around black communities, calling them undesirable, and encouraging realtors, banks, not to provide loans to whites who want to live in these communities, but also not to provide loans to blacks and other people of color to improve their property. And so when you have this kind of dual way of looking at a neighborhood, you end up with neighborhoods in which white communities are provided different sets of resources, low interest loans, loans to first time homeowners, loans to improve property. Whites get that. And these are tax payer subsidized loans. And African Americans in particular did not get these in their communities. And so their communities really over time not only became deinstitutionalized, but also became more dilapidated because they simply could not, the means were not there for people to take care of their property. We also know that African Americans were barred from moving into white neighborhoods. Again, this is not just the work of rogue racists, rogue white racists in those communities. The federal government backed these behaviors, again, by the way it's structured. If an African American wanted to get a loan to buy a house, to move into a white neighborhood, they could not get it. So it's not just a function of individual homeowners deciding who they did or did not want to move in a neighborhood. That's kind of the first level of racism. That second level is what the federal government propagated through its loan programs that were highly discriminatory.
And in addition to these, you know, programs and resources available to some individuals and not to others, there were other circumstances, other negative circumstances that have kind of been inflicted upon many of these Black-dominated neighborhoods. Things like pollution, sources of pollution nearby, right? Like coal-fired power plants and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thanks for bringing that up. And so that's another example of racism that goes beyond what one set of racial groups or people can do to another. When we look at coal-fired plants, pollution, we see, again, institutional racism at play through zoning. So zoning boards, not only were they very active in residential segregation, communities like Baltimore, a number of cities in the country decided, they used the zoning boards to literally declare blocks within each city as areas where only whites could live. So they literally had white blocks and Black blocks where Blacks could only live in these areas. And so, again, in addition to the banks and the federal government, you have city governments doing this all over the country. Those same zoning boards decide whether or not a neighborhood is going to be purely residential, or if it's going to be residential slash commercial, or residential slash commercial slash industrial. And when neighborhoods are zoned as commercial and industrial, they then tend to attract facilities in them. Many of these are polluting facilities that one really does not want to have homes with children, with older people living beside. And so the zoning board in rezoning communities have a tendency to rezone Black communities as industrial. And so with that happening, you then have corporations, other noxious industrial facilities locating their properties right in the midst of African-American communities. Another thing that we do see is, for instance, the location of highways and freeways. We have many cases, and I document these quite extensively in the book Toxic Communities. There's also another of my book, The Environment and the People in American Cities, where we see from the 1600s, African-American communities were used as the places where cities dumped their wastes.
Right.
Where they put their industrial facilities, whereas they created purely residential neighborhoods for wealthier residents and white residents. So again, this is not by happenstance. It is not accidental. There are deliberate structures that we see that go back hundreds of years in creating the patterns that we see today, where in many African-American communities, a freeway runs through it. Right. We could create that movie, and we could come up with cities like New Orleans, Detroit, Flint, Baltimore, Harlem, New York, Harlem. All of these neighborhoods are and communities were once vibrant communities that you put some of the most hideous freeways through. And when these freeways were put through, they weren't designed in the very same way as when freeways are going through or around rich white communities. Those freeways have noise barriers. They're sunken, or they're elevated to the point that you can protect the community. They also circumvent rather than go right down the middle. If you look at Detroit, the very vibrant Black community that used to be called Black Bottom, that had all the Black doctors, lawyers, nurses, teachers, firefighters, all these Black community members were homeowners, or most were homeowners. When the freeway that was going to connect Detroit to Lansing, which is the state capital, was being built, This is Michigan. There is a lot of open land that could be used if you curve the freeway. But no, it went like an arrow through the heart of that black community. The same thing happened in Chicago. And that black community, those homeowners, their homes were taken and they were put in housing projects. And so when we look at something like high-rise housing projects and look at why are black people in these projects in Chicago, in Detroit, black homeowners were turned into renters in housing and put in housing projects when their homes were taken for freeway construction.
Yeah, one thing I've learned recently, as I'm learning a lot, is with respect to environmental racism, is Africatown in Mobile, mm-hmm. Alabama, a part of Mobile, where a community of color established by ex-slaves. I mean, mm-hmm. it's that old. It has that much tradition. But one of the many abuses they suffered over time was that eventually a international paper, and then Scott Paper, came and put a plant, a pulp mill, in mm-hmm. Africatown. And then, this is back in the 50s and 60s when there was no Environmental Protection Agency. Therefore, raw industrial wastewater was introduced to the river. And of course, the stack spewed air pollutants, including chloroform, which then over years creates a cancer cluster. That's a classic example of environmental racism?
Yes, and it is repeated all over the country. The part of the country that we call Cancer Alley that goes from Baton Rouge, travels 90 miles south to New Orleans. A lot of the big chemical, 25% of all the chemical manufacturing in the country goes on in this area. And these are black communities. Many of them were communities that slaves on the slave plantations, when these were abandoned at the end of slavery, whites ran off and left these plantations derelict. The slaves on the plantations took them over and created communities out of them. And now companies like Shell have their big facilities right up against literally the fence line of the homes of the descendants of these slaves, polluting them, putting off fumes that are toxic, but also the fires that come from some of these facilities when they have explosions and when they dump materials into the Mississippi River. And the cancer clusters, that's why it's called Cancer Alley, the cancer clusters that go up and down this stretch of the river are unprecedented in the community. And so Cancer Alley is not alone. We see it in Emile, Alabama. You're talking about Africatown. If you come north into places like New Jersey, you see some of these very same patterns repeating themselves, with black communities being used as the space where you put the waste dumps, the oil refineries, the chemical plants, the smelly facilities that no one wants to live beside, ends up in black communities, Latinx communities. Native American reservations are also a place where we see a lot of these. A lot of the nuclear waste dumps in the country sit on Indian reservations. So there is an undeniable pattern that we see that is both a function of interpersonal racism, but this institutional, embedded, entrenched racism that goes through permitting processes, government sponsorship. We see it quite extensively in this country, in other industrialized countries in the North, and in emerging economies in the South.
Right.
So if you're just joining us, we're speaking this morning about environmental racism in the United States with Dr. Dorcida Taylor, a professor of environmental sociology at the University of Michigan. She's also the author of Toxic Communities, Environmental Racism, Industrial Pollution, and Residential Mobility. Dr. Taylor, one other thing that we wanted to talk about was kind of the path that you took to this topic and how you came to spend your career focusing and studying environmental racism. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Could you repeat the first part of your question? I'm sorry, I didn't quite get it.
We're interested in hearing from you about your career path and okay. how you came to study environmental racism and to focus on that.
Okay, great. I am originally from Jamaica and spent my first 20 years there. Since then, I've been living in the U.S. But in Jamaica, I was always kind of your classic STEM girl, biology, zoology, botany, spending a lot of time on those activities. And when I moved to the U.S. In the 1970s, and I was taking an environmental course because the advanced botany course was oversubscribed, couldn't get into it. So they said, why don't you take this environment course? And I did. I really started getting very interested in it because I could see a direct way of applying all that botany and zoology to a broader kind of understanding of environment. And in the class, I noticed I was the only non-white student in a class of about 50. And so I kind of naively asked the professor, you know, I said, where are the other black students? And he said, blacks are not interested in the environment without missing a beat. And I thought, I'm incredibly stupid. I'm going to go. I didn't say that, thank God, but that's what I was thinking. So I went to the library to look up some research to see, this America is a strange place. How can black people not be interested in environment? Because everything in my life experience prior to that showed me that not only were we interested as black people, we were extremely knowledgeable about things. Every research article I pulled said what he said. So I realized, you know, I am not in Kansas anymore. I'm now in Chicago, and in America, this notion that if you're black, you don't know anything about the environment, you're lacking in knowledge, you're ignorant about it, and you don't care about it. And so that stayed with me, because the idea that an entire group of people don't care about what they breathe, how clean the water is that they drink, how beautiful their surroundings are, and this is all related to skin color, makes very little sense, or made very little sense to me. So I continued to pursue it. And at the same time, I realized I didn't want to be a medical doctor, which is kind of what, if you spend a lot of time doing zoology, everyone believes you're going to do. I really became more interested in connecting people's perceptions, ideas, and behavior to environment and environmental outcome. And that was what led me to Yale to start pursuing master's degrees in the field. And then while I was there, I decided I needed to understand more about social structure. So I combined my degree in started working on my doctorate to do a joint doctorate with the School of Forestry Environmental Studies, where I was getting the forestry, natural resources, ecology part of my education with sociology, where I was starting to understand social structure, social outcomes, and from then I've just continued along that route, combining or thinking about how do these two things interact to get that really intersectional understanding of environment and people and outcomes.
Well, you also talk about how the racism or bias or outright bigotry you may have experienced joining environmental organizations like the Sierra Club that seemed to initially be dominated by all-white structure?
So several environmental organizations, and it's important to understand the where they come from and the rise of these organizations. And I try to trace that out because my students would often say, we don't understand, you know, all of this. And the environmental history books that were out there in the 80s, 90s, early 2000s were books that talked about the great conquests of white middle-class male. White women were largely left out of these narratives. The white working class was either stereotyped and left out, and certainly people of color were not included. So one book I wrote to try to remedy that is called The Rise of the American Conservation Movement, Power, Privilege, and Environmental Protection. And in that, you can see where these books came out, where these organizations, many of the early environmental organizations, came out of a very male space, men, and conquest in environmental settings. So did they go mountain climbing, hunting? Theodore Roosevelt, which is lifted up as one of our the first, quote-unquote, first environmental president. But he was an avid hunter, and he would go hunting when he was out in Wyoming. He, for instance, heard that there was a group of buffalo that was about to go extinct, and he and his buddies went hunting to find the last, you know, of the buffalo, the last of the herd, the last of the bears. So many of the old environmentalists, 19th century, come out of this tradition of hunting trophies. When you hunt, you kill, you stuff, you display it in your fireplace. Mm-hmm. That was a big part of what they did. Also, what they did was a lot of long-term hiking and being in that open space. They saw this as very elite sport. And they separated themselves from, like, the working class who hunted to put food on the table. In many spaces, blacks and people of color were demonized and weren't even allowed to hunt. So these early organizations, things like the Boone and Crockett Club, to join that club, you needed 8 trophy heads. To display that you were a big game hunter, you'd hunted in the West, and you had big species that you could check off. For the Sierra Club, you needed to have the equipment and the money to go hiking, you know, to the top of the peaks and the Sierras and other peaks. The only time people of color were involved in that were when they went as a cooks to wash the clothing and to carry the equipment of these wealthy men, and some women went on those early trips. Appalachian Mountain Club, if you were in the Audubon, you know, the adage, little old white ladies in white tennis shoes. I mean, these you had, again, to have the equipment and the social standing to belong to these organizations. Many of them openly discussed whether or not the working class and people of color should be invited to become parts of the membership. And these discussions went on all the way through the 60s with the outset of the civil rights movement and women's movement, labor movement. Some of them had really big discussions about whether or not civil rights issues around justice had any place in environment, in environmental organizations. And in many cases, many of the membership said no. You know, we are environment, social issues, justice issues are separate. There is no connection. Yet some of these organizations saw slavery take place in the country and did not speak up. And so it is important now, as we're watching these social issues around, like, police brutality, around very egregious forms of racism being meted out onto African Americans in particular, that environmentalists don't lose this opportunity to speak out against social injustice. Hmm. You know, Thoreau in the 18, the 1840s and 50s spoke out against in what he called an unjust government. Someone like John Muir didn't. And so as white environmentalists and white environmental leaders, the question will become, as people look back at this time period, what's going to be the legacy? Are you going to be that leader who sees these kinds of racism and say nothing, do not put the weight of your organization's resources to stop it? Or are you going to be the one to say, you know, what we have seen the police do to black people, are you going to be the one to say this has nothing to do with environment? Mm-hmm. Chris Cooper is a Harvard graduate and is a member of the board of the Audubon Society, the New York chapter. Yet a random white woman could weaponize her whiteness against him and call the police on him.
Right.
While he was bird watching. So he was doing what Frederick Law Olmsted designed Central Park to do, sit quietly and bird watch.
Right.
She was the one breaking the rules, having her dog run around the park. That's not what Central Park was designed to do. And for environmentalists to think that race has nothing to do with environment now, we're not in the 19th century anymore. We're now in the 21st century. Anyone who cannot see how it's connected really has a huge blind spot and really probably needs to start working on how to... Not everybody can link all this stuff on their own and immediately, but it's a time to start taking that first step.
Right.
Whites need to call out the Amy Coopers that are amongst them. And believe me, there are a lot of Amy Coopers amongst the groups that are either environmentalists or are their neighbors, are their friends, are their family members.
Right.
Absolutely. And those are powerful words and a powerful reminder for all of us as we go about our world and the environmental world. You know, Chris and I have talked about this to think about these things in this different way. So let's also talk for a minute about why it's important to have diversity in the environmental field, in environmental nonprofits and environmental science organizations. Because it goes far, far beyond doing the right thing, right?
Yes, diversity is very important in every kind of organization. Unfortunately, the environmental movement and organizations did not take that moment in the 60s, again, when we had civil rights, women's rights, the peace movement, labor movement. All of these were big social movements. And especially when we look at the labor movement, when we look at women's movement, these were movements that understood that they were more powerful if they built on a cross-cultural, multicultural class, cross-class basis and coalitions. Civil rights, Native American Indian rights, Chicanismo, Chicano rights, all of these movements took that opportunity. The environmental movement kind of put itself above the fray and continued with upper middle class white activists, white leaders, white organizational structures working in white communities for the benefits of whites. And so they're coming to the party a little bit late now, and there has been some progress on diversity. But diversity matters in the sense that when you have a diverse team of people from different backgrounds trying to solve problems, trying to develop institutional strategies, you have groups that are more efficient because you're getting a wider range of ideas to consider. You're getting a wider range of solutions to consider. And so so when you have multicultural people within an organization, yes, there are points at which there are going to be discomforts. There are points at which you're going to disagree. But that generates for you a better set of outcomes in the long term because you're using all the talent that's there. The U.S. and U.S. environmental groups cannot continue to ignore people of color. If you look at the demographics of the country, people of color will be a majority of the population of the country within the next 2 to 3 decades. If you have developed entire sets of organization workforce that does not tap into that talent pool, you're not going to be competitive for your workforce if you continue this pathway that, you know, when you look around and realize, oh, my Lord, I need to start hiring people of color. You don't have pipelines. You don't have connections. And you have not been recruiting and engaging these groups of folks. It will make it very difficult for you to catch up. It's also from the perspective of where does environmental support come from? Ironically, the most pro-environmental voting segment block in the Congress are black congressional representatives and senators. They consistently vote pro-environmental over white Democrats, over white Republicans and Republicans of color. So if you are also a group of organizations that rely on publicly elected officials to pass your legislation, to put in policies for you to protect the environment, if you don't engage the people who are represented by the group that votes more proactively for your bills, your policies, your laws, you're also shooting yourself in the foot. Because congressmen and congresswomen, they rely on their constituents to get them in office. And if those constituents go and say, hey, these environmental groups, they turn a blind eye to what's happening in our communities. They don't hire us. They don't talk to us. They don't engage us. Guess what's going to happen? So from a number of levels, it makes sense for environmental organizations to really broaden out what they're doing, incorporate communities of color, engage communities of color, share resources, but also understand that it is those collaborations really will help in the long haul.
Well, we only have about one more minute, Dr. Taylor, but when Nell and I talk to environmental scientists and policymakers about things like climate change and all these other things that are difficult conversations.
Huge issues.
We always want to end whether or not they're hopeful about with respect to changes that may come with respect to our attitudes and beliefs and actions to address climate change. So we have to ask you. And we only have a minute or so, so I apologize, but are you hopeful that you can see changes happening with respect to environmental racism?
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason I say yes is I have seen it changing for the better in terms of communities of color being understood, respected, and heard in what's going on. Mm. I've also seen more mainstream environmental groups recognize what's going on and start working. But the youth, the young millennials and others who are younger than millennials, they are not interested in going and working in all-white upper-middle-class organizations. They understand multicultural organizing, multicultural work, and they're not afraid of it like their grandparents and parents were. And so I put a lot of stock in what I see happening amongst the young people, amongst students that are coming into environmental programs now. White students understand if they only sit around and talk to other white kids, they're missing out a big piece of the understanding of the problem, approaching it and coming up with solutions. So they also want multiculturalism. And that's where I see a lot of change happening. I see a lot of people from a lot of different racial backgrounds demanding that environmental institutions, be it the academic institutions, the government institutions, the community-based national nonprofits, take a more intersectional approach and a more multicultural, cross-race, cross-class, cross-LGBTQ approach to understanding the problems and coming up with solutions.
Well, those are inspiring words. Yes. and a nice thought to take with us as we go into the world today. Dr. Dorceta Taylor, thank you so much for joining us this morning and sharing your time and your expertise.
Yes, thank you
so
much.
Thank you very much for having me. Have a nice day.
Thank you.